He walked barefoot through Babylon, armed only with truth, drumbeats, and dreadlocks. They called him the Quiet One, but he was never silent. He was the voice of the mystic drum. Bunny Wailer, founder, fighter, father, prophet. From trenched-down zinc fences to the hills of Zion, his journey was not just music, it was message. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean audiobook. If you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform, so you never miss a story. Today, we're honored to bring you Bunny Wailer, A Journey Through Time, Episode 3. Get ready to immerse yourself in a powerful narrative that goes beyond music, into legacy, resistance, and roots. Because here, our mission is simple. To keep our culture alive, one story at a time. Chapter 9, Warrior of Roots Reggae. The battlefield wasn't made of blood and bombs. It was built from bass lines and broken promises, and the war that Bunny Wailer fought in the 1980s and beyond wasn't declared in the streets. It was declared in the soul of the music. Reggae was no longer just a movement. It had become a marketplace. And as record labels fattened off the rhythm of resistance, Bunny Wailer stepped into the fray, not with bullets, but with truth. He had always known this day would come. Even during the Wailer's rise, Bunny saw the shadow of Babylon creeping into the melody. Executives in suits talking about chart placement, not liberation. Journalists more interested in the myth of Marley than the message of the music. Tours booked to maximize revenue, not resonance. Bunny had left the group in part because of that foresight, that quiet terror, that righteous fury he carried in his chest. And now, years later, that fear had bloomed into reality. Reggae had become a commodity. Bunny watched with a kind of sacred disappointment. Dancehall was rising fast, its rhythms infectious, its hooks sharp, its language bold, but its spirit, Bunny feared, had wandered far from the Nyabingi drum. Many of the new artists spoke less of repatriation, righteousness, and roots, and more of vanity, gunplay, and fleeting pleasure. The message had been traded for the moment, the depth for the dollar. And so, Bunny picked up his sword. He didn't attack individuals. He attacked ideologies. He warned the youth that they were being handed mirrors that reflected Babylon's image, not their own. He told them that slackness wasn't rebellion, it was seduction. That when a system can't destroy your power, it will mock it. Turn it into parody. Turn warriors into jesters. Turn prophets into pop stars. He was relentless. In interview after interview, Bunny remained uncompromising. Reggae is church, he repeated often. You sigh and turn church into circus. To many, it sounded harsh. To others, like prophecy. He called out the radio stations that refused to play roots unless it was repackaged through foreign tongues. He criticized government programs that ignored Rasta communities while celebrating reggae in their tourism brochures. He rejected awards that were offered for marketing purposes, not spiritual merit. And in all this, he walked alone. The industry, eager to commercialize the music, often saw Bunny as an obstacle. Too principled, too mystical, too unpredictable. They couldn't package him, couldn't convince him, couldn't use him. He was dangerous, because he remembered what they wanted to forget, that reggae was born in resistance. Born in the pain of slavery, the cry of exile, the fire of Garvey. It wasn't meant to be pretty. It was meant to provoke. So Bunny used his platform to protect the temple. Through songs like Roots, Radix, Rockers, Reggae, Crucial, and Rise and Shine, he returned again and again to themes of spiritual grounding, African identity, and moral clarity. Even when the rhythm got more polished, Bunny's message never softened. If anything, it sharpened. And he didn't just speak it. He lived it. He refused to record in studios that disrespected Rasta. Refused to collaborate with artists who mocked the message. Refused to be used as a nostalgic figure for festivals that treated reggae like a museum piece. To him, the drum was still alive. He invested in his own label, Solomonic Productions, where he could maintain control. Where no one could tell him to censor, clean up, or commercialize. Every note he released through Solomonic was on his terms. Righteous terms. Even if it meant less money. Even if it meant fewer stages. And he kept teaching. Young artists came to him. Not for deals, but for wisdom. They'd sit beneath almond trees in Kingston, where Bunny would roll a chalice and speak of the old days. Of how music could call lightning. Of how words could free or enslave. Of how Babylon was clever, but not eternal. Don't just play rhythm, he'd tell them. Be the rhythm. He gave away lessons most couldn't pay for. And in doing so, he sowed seeds into the next generation. Not all listened. But those who did, Those who truly listened carried a spark that couldn't be extinguished. The media didn't always know what to do with Bunny. He wasn't as easy to write about as Bob. He wasn't as fiery and quotable as Peter. Bunny was layered, poetic, philosophical. He didn't give soundbites, he gave parables. And when asked why he seemed so isolated, so out of step with the new industry, Bunny answered with a smile that carried both sorrow and satisfaction. I and I now move with D-World. I move with D-Word. He saw what few others could. That Babylon would wear a reggae mask. That it would dance to the rhythm while silencing the roots. That it would use the music's popularity to bury its meaning. But Bunny wouldn't let them. He continued to record, to perform, to speak. Not everywhere. Not often. But when he did, the earth shifted. His concerts felt less like shows and more like ceremonies, spiritual gatherings with bass lines. His voice, by now seasoned with age and purpose, trembled with authority. Every lyric carried decades of resistance. And still, despite the ridicule, the isolation, the pushback, he smiled. Because he knew something the industry didn't. He knew that trends fade, but truth echoes. He knew that slackness sells, but righteousness endures. He knew that while Babylon may dominate the charts, it could never silence the drum. And so he beat it louder. In studio, on stage, in the hills, in the silence, Bunny Wailer wasn't just preserving reggae. He was defending it. And in doing so, he became not just its voice, but its guardian. The warrior who never blinked. The elder who stood on a battlefield paved with speakers and gold records, holding high the flag of roots, chanting down Babylon, one righteous word at a time. Chapter 10, Family and Fatherhood. To the world, he was the mystic. The warrior. The prophet with dreadlocks and drumbeats in his chest. But behind the veils of smoke and stage lights, beneath the robes of Rasta colors and the armor of resistance, there lived a man who knew love. A man who carried children on his lap, wiped tears with calloused hands, and sat in silence at night wondering if his devotion to righteousness had cost him the intimacy of a simpler life. Bunny Wailer, born Neville O'Reilly Livingston, was not the type to flaunt his personal life. Unlike others in the spotlight who paraded lovers and lined up behind scandal, Bunny kept his affairs cloaked in shadows, not out of shame, but sacredness. He believed that love, like faith, should be guarded, not exploited, not commodified, and certainly never staged for public consumption. Still, love found him. And he found it, again and again, in brief, powerful chapters, scattered through time like soft verses between loud anthems. Bunny was not known for long public relationships, but rather for private connections that were deep, deliberate, and drenched in emotional fire. One of the most enduring presences in his life was Jean Watt, also known as Sister Jean. She was his longtime partner, his confidant, his spiritual equal. Their bond wasn't always perfect. It was often strained by the pressures of fame, spirituality, and Bunny's need for solitude. But it was rooted in something most couldn't touch, understanding. Bunny didn't need flattery. He needed depth. And Jean, in her quiet strength and unwavering patience, offered that. Together, they raised children, biological and spiritual. Bunny was a father, not just in name, but in action. He taught his children the ways of Rastafari, the meaning of Ital living, the sacredness of speech, the importance of integrity. He didn't push the spotlight on them. He offered them soil, silence, and scripture. He was not always present in the traditional sense. Touring, recording, fasting, and reasoning often kept him physically distant. But when he was home, truly home, he was there. Fully. No phone in hand. No rush to return to the stage. Just a man rolling dumplings, brewing bush tea, talking to his children like he talked to the stars, with wonder and truth. He would sit with them in the early mornings before the sun broke over the mountains, his voice a low hum, telling stories, not of his career, but of Africa, of Zion, of ancestral journeys. He didn't talk about fame. He talked about freedom. Bunny had many children, some born from youthful love, others from spiritual unions. He accepted them all, not as obligations, but as gifts. He didn't believe in the Western idea of family, boxed and labeled. His family was wide, expansive. Anyone who carried the spirit of righteousness could be his child. And many who grew up without fathers found in Bunny a surrogate, a man who didn't offer money, but offered meaning. And yet there was sorrow. There were moments, quiet, private ones, where Bunny felt the weight of the life he had chosen. The absence, the distance, the missed birthdays, the longing in a child's eyes when he packed his bags for another show. He carried that pain, not with guilt, but with grief. He had chosen the mission, chosen to be a shepherd. But the shepherd walks alone sometimes. He spoke of it rarely. But when he did, his voice dropped an octave. Me always try fi balance D word in D world. But John O, sometimes me heart split in two. Still, he never left the path. He taught his children not just to live, but to listen, to nature, to silence, to the voice of the Most High. He taught them how to plant food, how to chant psalms, how to question systems, how to protect the sacred. He raised them not for Babylon, but for Zion. As they grew, some followed in his footsteps, into music, into roots, into revolution. Others chose quieter lives, and Bunny never judged, because freedom, to him, was not about following his path, it was about finding yours. His home, tucked away in the hills of St. Thomas, was more than shelter. It was a sanctuary, a place of reasoning, a sacred ground where family gathered, not for Instagram pictures, but for grounding rituals, Nyabingi drumming, Ital feasts, and long conversations that stretched deep into the night. Those who visited remember Bunny not as a legend, but as a father figure, a teacher, a man who made you think harder, breathe slower, and feel your roots. He would laugh heartily, his laughter sudden and boyish, and then grow silent, his eyes distant, as if listening to voices only he could hear. But not all of Bunny's family stories had peace at the center. There were tensions, disagreements, misunderstandings. Like any man trying to live righteous in an unrighteous world, Bunny made mistakes. There were children who felt overlooked, partners who felt abandoned. And Bunny, in his moments of introspection, acknowledged those scars. He once said in a private recording never released to the public, "Me give me life fi D people, but sometimes me wish me coulda give more to D ones who hold me name." It wasn't regret. It was reflection. Because being a prophet comes with a price. And that price is often paid at the dinner table, in the echo of unanswered questions, in the spaces left empty by devotion to cause. In 2020, Jean what went missing. It was one of the most painful chapters of Bunny's final years. The woman who had walked beside him for decades, his spiritual anchor, his queen, vanished without a trace. He searched, prayed, called for public help. The man who had chanted down Babylon now stood helpless against the silence of a lost loved one. And through that pain, the world saw something rare. Bunny the father, Bunny the partner, stripped of mysticism. Just a man. An old man calling out for his beloved. The heartbreak was etched across his face. The lines deeper. The smile gone. His voice trembling in interviews. "Me just want her come home," he said. "Me spirit no rest." She never did. And that wound never healed. But Bunny did what he always did. He carried the pain like scripture. He folded it into prayer. He let it fuel his final songs, his final speeches, his final breaths. In the end, family was not what Bunny had, it was who he was. A father to many, a brother to the oppressed, a son of the drum, a husband to truth, a lover of righteousness. And even when the world only saw the legend, there, in the quiet corners of St. Thomas, in the soft soil of Jamaica's hills, was a man who kissed his children on the forehead, told them stories of Zion, and whispered to the wind like it was listening. Because it was. Chapter 11, Legacy of the Wailers. There are some weights only the last one can carry. Some silences only the survivor can hear. And as the years passed, as Marley's dreadlocked smile became a mural and Tasha's eyes turned to myth, Bunny Wailer found himself standing in the long, unlit hallway of memory alone. Not as a forgotten man, but as the keeper of the truth. The Wailers were no longer just a group. They had become legend. A holy trinity canonized in sound, sketched into global consciousness, and sold across continents in posters, vinyl, and documentaries. Bob Marley had become the face of reggae. Peter Tosh, the militant spirit. And Bunny Wailer, the soul. But in that sacred equation, Bunny had become the least visible. And yet he was the one still breathing, still hearing the echoes, still waking up in the middle of the night to old harmonies that lived like ghosts in his mind. When Bob died in 1981, the world stopped. Cancer had eaten through his body like Babylon devours prophets, slow, cruel, without apology. Bunny didn't cry in front of cameras. He didn't grandstand. He retreated to the hills, where the wind could catch his grief without translation. Their relationship had been layered, complex, beautiful, fractured. The bond forged in 9 Mile, in youth and struggle, had been tested by the machine of fame, by divergent spiritual paths, by decisions made in boardrooms far from Kingston soil. They had disagreed, sometimes bitterly, but they had also loved fiercely. And in the moment of Bob's death, all that was left was the ache. Bunny remembered Bob not as the icon the world adored, but as the boy who climbed mango trees barefoot, the boy who shared the last piece of hard dough bread, the boy who believed they could use their voices to build something eternal. He didn't attend every tribute. He didn't speak at every ceremony. He spoke when it mattered. And when he did, he said, Bob Marley was not a star. Him was a sun. Him shine upon the earth. But sun bring fire too. Bunny knew Bob had carried a burden. He knew the weight of being the one was not chosen. It was assigned. And while the world celebrated Bob's rise, Bunny watched the toll it took. The compromises. The physical exhaustion. The spiritual loneliness. He never envied Bob. He mourned him. When Peter Tosh was murdered in 1987, it felt like a dagger. Not just because Peter was family, but because his death, brutal, unjust, senseless, was a metaphor for everything Bunny had warned about. The system didn't need to silence Peter with censorship. It did it with bullets. Tosh was outspoken, unyielding, too defiant to be controlled. And in a country drowning in political corruption and unchecked violence, that kind of truth-telling was dangerous. Peter's death was not just personal. It was prophetic. Bunny wept for him, not just in body, but in spirit. Their friendship had been fiery. Their disagreements, legendary. But at the core, there had always been respect. A bond sealed by roots, by rhythm, by revolution. He said of Peter, "Dem kill him like him was a common man. But Peter Tosh was a general. Him walk with thunder." And so now, the Trinity was broken. The voices that once harmonized beneath zinc rooftops were no longer three. Only one remained. The burden of being the last whaler was not glory. It was grief. It was memory without company. Echoes with no answer. Interviews that asked for nostalgia, but not truth. Because Bunny remembered things the world had sanitized. The arguments. The betrayals. The lawyers who tried to erase his name from publishing credits. The managers who favored Marley and cut corners with contracts. The unspoken tensions that grew in silence while the cameras rolled. He didn't seek revenge, but he sought justice. There were legal battles. Bunny fought to protect the legacy, not just his own, but the legacy of the Wailers as a unit. He sued for unpaid royalties, for rightful credit, not because he craved riches, but because history needed correction. The world, he believed, had gotten it wrong. Bob didn't do it alone. Peter wasn't just a rebel. And Bunny wasn't the quiet one. He was the backbone, the original harmony, the spiritual compass. But fame has a way of rewriting stories. And so Bunny resisted. He began creating his own archival projects, re-releasing older tracks, curating recordings, telling stories the industry refused to print. He did interviews on his own terms, controlling the narrative. He spoke to journalists who respected the roots, not just the legend. And when asked how it felt to be the last Wailer, his voice often cracked. "It's a lonely thing," he said once. "Me carry de voices of two kings in me chest every day. Sometimes it heavy." He admitted he still heard them. Bob in his dreams, Peter in the wind. Sometimes, he said, he would walk through the house and swear he heard a harmony from the corner of the room. A laugh from the kitchen. A line that wasn't written yet. Bunny wasn't haunted. He was inhabited. By memory. By music. By the echoes of a brotherhood torn by time. But he also smiled. Because legacy wasn't just loss. It was also life. He saw the next generation rising. Children of reggae, artists of roots, revolutionaries who quoted his lyrics, studied his harmonies, carried Blackheart Man like a Bible. He mentored them quietly. Opened his gates to the worthy. Never for clout. Always for the culture. And sometimes, late at night, he would play those early Wailers songs. Alone. No audience. No applause. Just a man. A memory. And the music that would never die. Chapter 12, Lion in the Garden. There comes a time when the warrior lays down the staff, not in surrender, but in stillness. When the prophet no longer needs to shout. When the lion no longer needs to roar to remind the forest who he is. In the later years of his life, Bunny Wailer withdrew, not from purpose, but from noise. The concerts became fewer. The interviews rare. The public appearances? Carefully chosen, measured like sacred steps. To the outside world, it may have looked like fading, but those who understood him knew better. Bunny was not fading. He was rooting. In the lush hills of St. Thomas, Jamaica, Beyond the glare of Babylon, Bunny cultivated his sanctuary. A home, yes, but more than that. It was a garden in the spiritual sense. A place where the soil was a mirror, where the breeze carried old rhythms, where the silence was a symphony only mystics could hear. He planted trees with the same hands that once held microphones. He grew herbs, vegetables, fruits, not just for food, but for communion. Everything he touched had purpose. His land was alive with birdsong and scripture, and he walked it barefoot, dreadlocks brushing his shoulders like whispers from the ancestors. Visitors who came were welcomed like pilgrims. There was no VIP area, no plastic smiles, just a man, his land, and the living presence of the Most High. Young artists, journalists, elders, and spiritual seekers, some invited, some simply guided by fate, sat with Bunny in the shade of guango trees. They listened, not just to his words, but to his being. And Bunny, when he spoke, gave no performance. He reasoned, softly, firmly, with the weight of a man who had lived every lyric, every chant, every sacrifice he ever sang about. He talked about the state of the world, the moral decay he saw in Jamaica's youth, the unchecked greed, the way Babylon had infected even the sound systems with spiritual amnesia. Music not supposed to confuse, he said. It's supposed to remind. He spoke of roots, not just musical ones, but cultural, ancestral, agricultural. The loss of farming, the loss of family, the fading of Rasta principles in the glare of capitalism. He lamented the way young Rastas were being raised without context, adorning themselves in the colors, but lacking the conviction, wearing the crown, but forgetting the throne. And yet he never condemned, because Bunny was still teaching, still building, still believing. He often walked with a staff carved from Jamaican cedar, worn smooth from his grip. It wasn't just a symbol. It was a tool for balance, for grounding, for ceremony. When he tapped it on the earth, it felt like a heartbeat. He spent long hours in solitude, reading psalms, chanting, listening to Nyabingi drum recordings, writing in notebooks with frayed edges, praying, not with words, but with breath. He didn't need a stage. The trees were his audience now, the wind his applause. And when the sun went down, he'd sit outside and watch the stars rise. He once told a visitor, "Me see Peter in dat star, and Bob in dat one. Dem never leave. Dem just shift vibration." Bunny wasn't hiding from the world. He was becoming the world. But the lion never fully rests. He still released music, on his terms. He curated unreleased tracks, produced roots compilations. He oversaw remasterings, not for profit, but preservation, to keep the fire lit, to keep the drum beating, long after he was gone. And he still performed occasionally, selectively. When he did, the atmosphere was reverent. Fans cried. Musicians stilled. Younger artists held their breath as the Black Heart Man took the stage, moving slower now, but with the gravity of mountains. He didn't dance like before. He didn't need to. He stood, staff in hand, robes flowing, voice rich with the thunder of all he had seen and all he had survived. When he sang Dreamland, the crowd did not cheer. They wept. When he sang Black Heart Man, it wasn't music, it was incantation. And when he said Ja Rastafari, the hills themselves seemed to echo. Behind the peace of his garden, however, was pain. Years of resisting Babylon had left their mark, financial strain, betrayal, and more personal heartbreak than most could carry. In 2020, the deepest wound opened when Jean Watt, his life partner and spiritual twin, went missing. The woman who had stood beside him through revolutions, through silence, through faith, simply vanished. He was devastated. Bunny, the lion, the last wailer, cried publicly. He issued pleas. He offered rewards. He walked with eyes scanning every road, every corner, every face in the marketplace, hoping to see her, hoping for a sign. But none came. He withdrew even more. And in private moments, those who were close said he spoke less, ate less, laughed rarely. The garden grew quieter. His children, friends, and spiritual brethren did what they could. But grief is a private language, one that Bunny knew fluently. The loss of Jean was not just loss of love, it was the unraveling of the last sacred thread. Yet even in sorrow, he did not curse Jah. Even in despair, he did not abandon his post. He continued to chant, continued to tend his land, continued to speak when called upon. He said little of his health, even as it began to falter. His strokes came like whispers in the night, uninvited, cruel, inevitable. And each time, he returned slower, softer, but still present. Because Bunny was not a man of escape. He was a man of endurance. And in those final years, he gave us his greatest gift, presence. Not in stadiums, but in spirit. Not in headlines, but in heartbeat. Bunny Wailer was not fading in the garden. He was returning to it, to the soil, to the word, to the silence that had always been louder than any bass line. And when the wind rustled the trees in St. Thomas, when the birds sang in the early morning, when the rain tapped soft on the zinc rooftops, if you listened carefully, you could hear the lion speak. Not with roar, but with peace.